Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear about challenges in getting COVID-19 vaccines to certain populations, including the Black community. Some blame systemic racism in healthcare that has led to a lack of trust among people of color. Others say government could be doing a better job. We'll find out more. Seed companies are doing well thanks to a boom in backyard gardening, but the coronavirus has brought challenges that have made it harder to fill orders. Adam Kinzinger's profile has risen since he took a hard stance supporting the impeachment of former President Donald Trump. Kinzinger's a Republican who grew up in central Illinois. We'll hear from people who've known him a long time and what they think of the congressman.
He's not going to act like a lot of other people and pretend to sweep things under the rug that he knows are wrong because he actually has a moral compass.
Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about media literacy. Can it combat misinformation? The coronavirus has spotlighted racial inequities in healthcare. We'll learn how some groups are working to find solutions. And we'll also hear why seed companies have faced some challenges getting out their orders this winter. That's all ahead on Statewide. First up this week, Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger's support for impeachment of former President Donald Trump helped make Kinzinger a national political figure. But he's also taking heat from many within his own party, even within his own family. Eric Stock reports those who followed the early days of Kinzinger's political career in McLean County are not surprised by his success or the courage that has put his career in jeopardy.
Eric Rankin is a fierce Democrat and former head of the McLean County Democratic Party. Rankin became friends with Adam Kinzinger in grade school. They lived on the same street in South Bloomington. They hung out a lot. Even then, Rankin says Kinzinger didn't lack confidence.
Adam rode the bus and he told everybody he was going to run for Congress someday. That's not even a made-up story. And we all laughed at him. I guess we're the ones that look like fools.
Kinzinger studied political science at Illinois State University. One of his professors was Gary Class. The now retired Class says Kinzinger was a good student who enjoyed a good debate.
I remember him as kind of a little bit conservative, but in my class, I really liked having students on both sides.
It turned out to be good prep for later. Kinzinger says there were times he was the only conservative in the classroom.
And I think that taught me to be able to stand alone and to be able to defend your position without having to have people around you to support you.
Kinzinger still had a lot to learn. Friend Eric Rankin says Kinzinger struggled to focus in school.
Much like typical 18-year-old, you know, middle-class white America, he was a bit of a knucklehead. And just really couldn't find a way to make the academic side work with his social side.
Those distractions almost ended Kinzinger's college career early. Kinzinger says he refocused and graduated on time.
And I give ISU a lot of credit for that. I know they had no idea who I was. I was a number, applying, but they let me back in. They gave me a second chance.
Kinzinger found purpose in politics, and Eric Rankin says it helped him get his act together. At age 20, Kinzinger ran for McLean County Board and beat an incumbent to become the youngest to serve on the board. That was in 1998. George Gordon served on the board with Kinzinger. Gordon is a Democrat. He says Kinzinger was conscientious. Gordon recalls when the board was divided on naming a new chair, Kinzinger wanted to hear from advocates for both candidates.
What struck a couple of us particularly, we talked about this, was how carefully he went about the decision-making process. And at that point, he was 22.
Kinzinger didn't just settle for ordinary duties on the county board. David Selzer also served with Kinzinger. The two Republicans pushed to abolish the elected recorder's office and move the duties to the county clerk to save money. Selzer says he could tell Kinzinger had the courage of his convictions.
I think that Adam came to the county board with that already shaped. I believe that his parents raised their children with this belief in themselves.
Kinzinger's family grounding included his father, Russ, who ran a faith-based homeless shelter in Bloomington. Retired ISU professor Bob Bradley says Kinzinger saw people in need at an early age. Bradley says that animates Kinzinger's sense of service and values.
As a conservative,
you rely on private community entities to help people rather than relying exclusively or primarily on the government for assistance. And he has seen that directly.
Kinzinger resigned from the county board in 2003 to join the Air Force. Kinzinger says he was inspired to serve after the 9/11 terror attacks. Back then, Kinzinger said military life provides something politics can't.
I look at it and I see, you know, real unity. There's almost a brother and a sisterhood in it of people that, you know, every day have to wake up with the thought that at some point they may be called to give their lives for the other person. And you know, again, I love politics. That's kind of an area I think that's missing in politics.
Kinzinger served in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he never gave up on politics. Friend Eric Rankin says joining the Air Force grounded Kinzinger. In 2006, Kinzinger saved a woman who was being attacked at knife point in Milwaukee. Rankin says Kinzinger's profile continued to rise.
You could just see that his story was starting to write itself. Adam thought and cared about other people.
Kinzinger recently began his sixth term in Congress. It might also be his most perilous. After the January insurrection, Kinzinger called for Donald Trump to be impeached and removed from office. Two county GOPs in his district have censured Kinzinger. A family member even sent a letter saying Kinzinger was working for the devil's army. Former McLean County Board member George Gordon says Kinzinger knows the risk he takes in trying to reshape a party that is still loyal to Donald Trump.
I'm impressed with his guts. He has shown, as I say, a lot of political courage.
Friend Eric Rankin says when Kinzinger says he vows to change the Republican Party, even if it costs him his career, he means it.
He's not going to act like a lot of other people and pretend to sweep things under the rug that he knows are wrong, because he actually has a moral compass. Politicians with a moral compass these days are actually very few and far between.
Rankin says he and Kinzinger are still friends. They are political opposites. Rankin says their political views never got in the way of friendship because disagreements are never personal. Rankin says he and Kinzinger stay in touch, but even he doesn't know what Kinzinger wants to do next. Stay in Congress, run for higher office, start his own foundation, or something else. Rankin is watching Kinzinger put his career on the line to change a party Rankin has opposed for much of his life. Yet if Kinzinger called Rankin and asked him to work on something, Rankin says he'd likely say yes. I'm Eric Stott.
When Republicans in Will County censured Kinzinger recently, the congressman issued a statement saying the Will County GOP has failed to help local Republicans get elected. He says they should spend more time on that than, quote, petty censure votes. For our most recent Illinois Issues report, Christy Kennedy has written about media literacy education, and Maureen McKinney spoke with her. Kennedy explains it's a way to combat conspiracy theories, such as baseless rumors of rampant election fraud and misinformation about COVID-19.
Some educators you interviewed had teachable moments in their classrooms. Can you tell me more about that?
Virginia Boyle, who is a teacher at Dr. Campos Puerto Rican High School in Chicago, told me a story about how some of her students had attended some of the Black Lives Matter rallies and protests in Chicago, and they came to her class after hearing that BLM Chicago supported looting. So using news articles, the group's website, and other materials, they found that a member had said that he supported looting. But in another interview, the group's president explained that that was the member's personal view and that BLM Chicago did not condone looting.
In that case, the teacher was able to show students how to find accurate information. Is that enough?
So when you first think about media literacy, you only think that it's about being able to spot disinformation. But it turns out that there's a lot more to it than that. It's looking at the information that we choose to consume, then looking at our own biases and shortcomings that make us human. And students use those skills every day, whether they realize it or not. With the pandemic, they're online a lot. And beyond that, they're accessing and creating all kinds of media.
How does that impact how we think about the world?
According to a Pew Research Center study, then more than 80% of us have smartphones. So we all have access to information all the time. We're just saturated in it. I interviewed Mike Spike, student at Northwestern University. He's a media literacy expert, and he explained that we all live in these information ecosystems and that some of us might only have social media in our ecosystem. Some of us might have richer systems with legitimate news organizations and other sources. And then that's the information that we're using to navigate the world. So we need to think about the quality of the information we consume and whether or not it's polluted with material that maybe isn't fact-checked or only contains one biased view.
Tell me more about how our ecosystems can be polluted.
So I also interviewed David Rapp, who's a psychology professor at Northwestern University, and we talked a lot about the shortcomings that we have as humans in consuming information. So our brains are wired in a way that affects how we're able to take in and analyze information. We're more likely to gravitate towards information that agrees with our own underlying core beliefs, and then we spin that information in our minds to agree with those beliefs. And then our brains pause over information that we know is false. You know, during a pandemic or times that we're scared or living in unrest, so the pandemic or Black Lives Matter protests, if you're living, you know, in an area where there's looting at the time of the looting, you know, we're living in fear. So we're worse at seeing our own shortcomings, and we might have less energy or time to analyze or verify the information we're taking in. And then there are groups that take advantage of those times to promote their own agendas. So the baseless stories about widespread voter fraud is a good example of that. Jonah Rubin, an anthropology assistant professor at Knox College, told me that media literacy has a place in all school subjects. And he talked a lot about the success of our future depending on young people being able to learn these skills because they're going to be solving future problems.
That's author Christy Kennedy. We have a link to her article on media literacy education. It's at our website at statewideshow.com. This weekend marks a change for Illinois residents who live in the 217 area code. They now need to dial a full 10-digit number when making local calls. The area code encompasses cities like Springfield, Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and Quincy. The change is due to the launch of a new 447 area code, which will be overlaid on the 217 region at the end of March. George Light is an engineering analyst with the Illinois Commerce Commission. He says there are still millions of unassigned 217 individual phone numbers, so residents may not encounter the 447 area code for some time.
The overlay was ordered so that there would be minimal disruption to folks in as much as we didn't split the area code so that no one would have to change their phone number.
Customers will not be charged extra for calls made between 217 and 447 area codes. With tens of thousands of Americans dying every year from opioid overdoses, there's an urgent need for scientists to develop alternatives to potentially addictive opioid painkillers. U of I Comparative Biosciences professor Aditi Doss is one of the researchers looking into the issue. Doss studies how the body handles lipids, a class of molecules that include dietary fats like omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, which are found in fish, nuts, and other foods. She spoke with Christine Herman about her latest study, which explores whether naturally occurring lipids can be used for the treatment of pain.
I think when people consume fatty acids, they talk about, omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids. They just think of them as, you know, food they are consuming. What they don't think about is how these are processed in the body to generate this huge class of lipid signaling molecules or, you know, metabolites that have many, many different functions. And they can affect things starting from cardiovascular health, inflammation, cancer, neurological diseases. So what my lab is interested in is to understand the biochemistry behind it. Like, what's the link between omega-3, omega-6 fatty acid consumption and all these different diseases?
So in your study, you took two naturally occurring lipids. You did this chemical modification to them, which is something that happens under inflammatory conditions in the body. And then what exactly did you test them for? What were you looking for?
What I was interested in is under inflammation, there are lots of enzymes that goes up in the body, right? Inflammation, pain. So those enzymes convert these naturally occurring molecules into the epoxide. So I looked at the epoxides, but then there are, of course, many other modifications these enzymes do. And then I looked at when these epoxides are formed, then how do they interact with some of the receptors that are known to be involved in pain? So for instance, the cannabinoid receptor, like, you know, people know that link even from cannabis, like cannabis is supposed to help in pain. So they know cannabinoid receptor trip channels that are also what cannabis interacts with. So the molecules that these are being generated in the body also interact with the same receptor as what cannabinoids interact with. We were looking at the same targets. And then we collaborated with Professor Hongjin Hu, who is from the Department of Anesthesiology in Washington, St. Louis, who has a much more handle on pain and itch. So he looked at how these molecules interact with DRG neurons. The DRG neurons are primary cell lines, means they are isolated from the mice in real time and then used. So these DRG neuron or dorsal root ganglion neurons are in the sensory neurons, and that is where the pain sensation is, you know, captured and then sent to the brain. So what we realized is these molecules in the DRG neurons will suppress the, you know, ideally the pain sensation.
What are next steps now for this research?
So I'm interested actually to look for more lipid metabolites in the brain, which are derived from the omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids that will interact with these receptors. And also, of course, to understand more about their pharmacology. So next step will be, you know, moving to a preclinical model or look for more metabolites like this, which are more stable. The other interest is, can we stabilize these molecules and use them maybe potentially as drugs? But these molecules are pretty transient in the body. Lipids are typically not used for drugs, but nowadays lipids are becoming quite popular. So yes, they are a little unstable, but if the pharmacology is good, I think people should put effort in trying to stabilize and use them for drug. And there is actually one lipid-based drug, which is, I think, in clinical trials, which is very similar lipid metabolite molecule, stabilized and supposed to be an anti-pain drug targeting neuropathic pain. So there are some previous examples. So this is not completely a new kid on the block.
That's Aditi Das, associate professor at the University of Illinois, speaking with Christine Herman. There's still more ahead on Statewide. After the break, we'll hear about efforts to bring equity into the process of getting COVID-19 vaccinations. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois has given more than 2 million COVID-19 vaccinations, but black residents in Sangamon County in central Illinois are less likely to have gotten the shots, mirroring statewide and national trends. State and county health officials point to hesitancy, a distrust of the medical establishment about getting vaccinated, as a reason for the gap. But as Mary Hansen reports, equity advocates say access plays a role too.
In her years as a practicing physician, Illinois Department of Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike always had trouble convincing her black patients to get an annual flu shot.
There's this longstanding history of, you know, some skepticism, hesitancy when it comes to injections, to flu shots.
During a virtual event hosted by Black Lives Matter Springfield about systemic racism and the coronavirus pandemic, Ezike lamented that the virus has preyed upon communities of color, sickening and killing them at higher rates.
Now, when we have this life-saving resource, those same individuals are wary.
Ezike said vaccine hesitancy is why there are racial disparities in who is rolling up their sleeves to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The disparity is present in Sangamon County, where 4% of vaccine doses have gone to black residents, who make up 13% of the county's population.
We're aware of the disparities and those things, but we didn't focus on that. We were just going by the priorities that were set up by CDC.
That's Sangamon County Department of Public Health Director Gail O'Neill. She says the racial makeup of the county's population might not match those who the CDC says should be currently eligible to get the shots, the elderly, medical professionals, and some frontline workers. County and health officials are discussing how to deploy 2 Illinois National Guard mobile vaccination units in a way that addresses some of the current disparities. The county is partnering with Southern Illinois University School of Medicine on a community outreach plan, particularly for medically underserved and minority populations. Still, advocates like Dr. Vineet Arora say education and outreach shouldn't be the sole focus.
My concern is that everybody jumps to the hesitancy, which sort of blames the population.
Arora is a Chicago-based physician and co-founder of Illinois Medical Professionals Action Collaborative Team. The group advocates for evidence-based solutions to the pandemic. She says the current system for getting a vaccine appointment is flawed. Pharmacies and local health departments around the state, including in Sangamon County, have relied almost entirely on online sign-up systems, which release limited batches of appointments that are generally snapped up in a matter of minutes or hours.
There's no way that a person who has less technology capability or lack of broadband or simply just doesn't have the time because they're an essential worker.
Arora points to the Protect Chicago Plus vaccination program in the majority Latino Belmont Cragen neighborhood, sponsored by the Chicago Department of Public Health. Partnering with community groups, volunteers went door to door getting residents signed up for appointments. Vaccinations were given at a local school, a place familiar to residents. Dr. Ali Khan is the medical director of Oak Street Health, the program's healthcare partner. He says the effort that more than doubled the number of residents vaccinated in the neighborhood shows,
while there may be many who are vaccine hesitant, or as I like to say, vaccine vigilant, that there are also a lot of people whose hands are raised to receive this vaccine, but they're not sure how to make their hands seen by anyone who can actually get them that vaccine in the first place.
Khan and Arora say increasing access to the vaccine for communities of color should happen at the same time as vaccine education efforts. Efforts like the Black Lives Matter Springfield virtual panel we heard about earlier. Dr. Wendy Wills-Elamine told the panel she's a little hopeful after a conversation with a patient recently who normally refuses a flu shot, but he wants the COVID vaccine.
He said, I don't see people dying from the flu. I see people dying from this, and I want my shot.
Wills-Elamine is a physician and dean of equity, diversity, and inclusion at SIU School of Medicine.
This has impacted our community in a different way, and we have ability to create a new legacy.
I'm Mary Hansen.
National surveys show there is more skepticism about the coronavirus vaccine among Black communities. Mary Hansen talked with U of I Springfield professor Tiffany Saunders about the origins of the hesitancy. In a warning, this interview includes a brief graphic description that may be upsetting to some listeners.
Often when we talk about vaccine hesitancy in the Black community and distrust of the medical establishment sort of more broadly, the conversations often start with a Tuskegee experiment, and we'll get into that in a minute, but you actually talk about it starting much earlier. Can you tell me about that?
I like to go back to slavery. People often say, I'm tired of hearing about like slavery or things like that, but it really is the root of many of the things that we see today. So once legislation was passed that said we could no longer import slaves, it became really important to take care of the health of slaves. White doctors really became important in thinking about the health of slaves. And this led to what scholars now call medical plantation. So doctors would be performing different types of medical procedures on slaves, and especially women slaves, because they're the ones who are responsible for offspring. And so what started happening is that women slaves, due to the work, were developing what they call vaginal fistulas, which made it really hard for them to both conceive, but also to give birth to new slaves. And so they might be sold or given to a doctor to be on the medical plantation, to have medical procedures done on them. And so this is really the origins of the birth of modern gynecology, but it's also, many scholars argue, the origin of the birth of some of the hesitancy when it comes to the Black community and the medical profession sort of more broadly.
With that background, let's talk about the Tuskegee syphilis study. It was a study that ran from the 1930s to the 1970s, looking at the effects of syphilis and enrolled Black sharecroppers. During that time, there was a cure developed for the disease, but it wasn't offered to them. For you, what can we learn from that study?
part of what was happening under slavery is also conceptions and understandings of the Black body and the worth of the Black body. And so those sorts of ideas carry forward into this Tuskegee experiment as well, right? So what we get there is Black bodies seen as maybe less valuable, less worthy. We're also talking about poor individuals. So there's also the sort of social class component. It's maybe another word, and it's a hard word to say, is disposable. So we can allow something as dangerous, and we knew syphilis was dangerous at the time, to go through people's bodies because we didn't respect them as sort of people and human beings. One of the things that I like to remind us is that it wasn't really that long ago. I was born in 1980, so you figure that particular study was ending just years before I was born. And so when you think about my parents and grandparents growing up or living through knowledge of that study, you can understand how some of those fears get passed down to sort of future generations. And this is where some of the origins of that intergenerational trauma comes from.
So let's continue bringing it up to today. How is all of what we've talked about so far relevant in discussions about the coronavirus pandemic?
So I think having knowledge of those experiments makes some members of the Black community skeptical of what's happening with this virus, you know, with this vaccine as well, right? So there's this fear because of this knowledge of previous sort of government run, you know, Tuskegee was government run. You could see where there'd be, where that fear, while we might see it as irrational, maybe has a rational place and rational roots as well.
On a more personal level, what are you hearing from friends and family, and sort of how are you responding to it when it comes to questions about the vaccine?
I'm really the person that my family is coming to for information, and not because I'm a medical doctor, but because they know I can find information. And so they'll come to me and say, you know, what are you hearing about this vaccine? What do you know about it? I've had to do quite a bit of troubleshooting on questions about, it was produced so quickly that leads to, you know, discomfort. And so I had to go and find those articles about how this has actually been in the works for a while, but now we had money to fund that research. And so it's the money that made the research advance really quickly. And so the role that I'm really playing is that sort of in my family and my community, I'm the one that they're going to say, you know, to go to with their questions. And then it's up to me to go and find the answers, the appropriate answers to help alleviate some of even those questions and concerns.
And so what are you going to be looking for? What would you like to see from both the medical community and public health officials when it comes to talking about this vaccine and distributing this vaccine?
Yeah, so I think they're already doing some really great things, but I think it's going to be really important to get in those communities, go to those neighborhoods. You know, Dr. Ezekie got the vaccine live so people could see that she was doing it too. I think that that's really important. So it's like the same people who have been cautioning us about the coronavirus also getting the vaccine is helpful for communities to see. Again, I just think it's going to take getting in the streets, going to the neighborhoods, talking to the people there. Maybe also when it comes time for a broader rollout, bringing mobile, you know, vaccination centers, buses, whatever, to the neighborhoods as well. Like, let's make it easier for people to get vaccines as well, because we know that there's going to be an equity and access issue. If you bring it to them, they may also be more likely to get it than if they have to try to take off from work or make an appointment. So I think there's a lot of ways to actually meet people where they are. And I think that that's going to be important to getting people vaccinated.
That's UIS sociology professor Tiffany Saunders talking with NPR Illinois' Mary Hansen. Governor Pritzker's expansion of 1B eligibility for COVID-19 vaccine took effect this week. That means pregnant women are now among those eligible to get the shot, in addition to those with conditions like diabetes or COPD. But should they? Well, the answer is complex. Tim Shelley spoke with Dr. Michael Leonardi, a maternal and fetal medicine specialist at OSF St. Francis Medical Center, about the potential pros and cons. That's Dr. Michael Leonardi of OSF St. Francis Medical Center speaking with Tim Shelley. And a reminder that 1B vaccine eligibility for pregnant women varies by community.
One of the comorbidities that makes an otherwise typical patient higher risk for having complications is pregnancy. So yes, most women who are pregnant, if they were to get COVID, would do fine and not have any adverse consequences. But we know that if we compare pregnant women to identical non-pregnant counterparts, say identical twins, one's pregnant, one's not, both get COVID, the pregnant patient is about 3 times more likely to be admitted to the hospital, 3 times more likely to need to be in an intensive care unit, a couple of times more likely to be on a ventilator, and actually 1.5 times more likely to die than the non-pregnant person. As far as any medication in pregnancy goes, it's always important to say, what are the risks of the medication? But what are the risks of the disease if we don't treat it, right? There are not human studies of safety in pregnancy for the vaccine. But what most of your listeners probably don't know is that no drug is tested for safety in human pregnancy, because we can't figure out an ethical way to do that.
The fact that no medication really is tested in clinical studies on pregnant women specifically, I think it's an interesting point. And I believe Dr. Fauci said they were now aware of 20,000 pregnant women who had gotten the vaccine and hadn't had any major complications. Is that correct?
That number will change every day. If you look at frontline healthcare workers, the people at the bedside, they're overwhelmingly reproductive age women. So there's an awful lot of pregnant women who have been immunized because they work in healthcare. And there's not been any increased risk or incidence of side effects or from the vaccine. You know, I think that one of the normal human nature kinds of concerns, and one of the reasons why moms are so amazing, is, you know, there's a concern about birth defects, for example. We know that development of the fetus when birth defects can happen is a short period of time, really early in the first trimester. So patients who are getting immunized after 16 weeks, and pregnancy is 40 weeks long, all the organs are formed. They just need to develop and become bigger and that sort of thing. So vaccines administered later aren't going to cause birth defects, as an example. And, you know, it's a personal decision, but I think an important consideration is, do I want to wait till 100,000 or a million people have had the vaccine who are pregnant? Optimally, yes. But what happens to me if I get COVID prior to that threshold being reached?
You mentioned like 16 weeks, right around that mark is when organs are fully developed. So let's say a mother is 8 weeks. So should she consider getting the vaccine now when it's available, or should she say, I'm going to wait a few weeks on this?
So that's a great question, and not a simple answer, because there's a lot of moving pieces there. What I would say to a patient who asked me that is, I would encourage you to look at, what is your risk? Getting vaccinated does not eliminate the need for masking, social distancing, hand hygiene, and that sort of thing. The person needs to figure out what their individual risk profile is and what their risk tolerance is. And the patient may say, you know what, I'm able to control my risk, and I would personally feel more comfortable waiting till 14 or 16 weeks. And I would say that I think that's very appropriate. I wouldn't disagree with it. But the additional factor that is clearly changing every day is, if there's vaccine available today, will there necessarily be vaccine supply available to you when you get to the point in pregnancy that you're comfortable getting vaccinated with? And I don't think we know that for sure. So I think it makes it a really difficult decision for families and pregnant women.
That's Dr. Michael Leonardi of OSF St. Francis Medical Center speaking with Tim Shelley. And a reminder that 1B vaccine eligibility for pregnant women varies by community. A new lawsuit against the University of Illinois claims the university failed to investigate claims of sexual harassment and assault in a timely and adequate manner. Attorney Allison Wilkinson represents the two former students from China who are seeking about $12 million from the school for pain and suffering. She says students under the professor's guidance were especially vulnerable, as their visa status could be contingent on whether he passed them.
No one felt empowered to do anything about it. So the professors, the students, they didn't really know what to do.
The U of I has been scrutinized for its handling of sexual misconduct claims in recent years, including those against Gary Hsu, the professor at the center of the allegations. He was one of several subjects of reporting by NPR Illinois and ProPublica that detailed a pattern of the university allowing professors accused of sexual misconduct to quietly resign. Some, including Hsu, collected pay after investigations found they violated policies. In a statement, a spokesperson for UIUC said the university was aware of the most recent lawsuit but could not comment on its contents. An attorney for the former professor did not respond to requests. There's still more ahead here on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, maybe you've spent the winter cozying up to a seed catalog. Getting the orders to people has proven a challenge for seed companies during COVID-19. That report is on the way. A small group of dedicated enthusiasts has been racing pigeons in St. Louis for the past century. And as Shayla Farzan first reported last year, the club is trying to keep the tradition alive and maintain its strong, close-knit community. Today we revisit that report.
Charlie Klipsch pulls his silver minivan into a parking lot along Interstate 44 in St. Clair, Missouri. He pops open his trunk, revealing 25 pigeons peering back at him from inside two cages. These aren't your typical city birds. They're homing pigeons with an uncanny ability to navigate hundreds of miles back home. Klipsch lifts the cages from his trunk and sets them on the ground.
All right, we're gonna do it on three. One, two, three.
The pigeons burst through the open door in a blur of wings. They circle for a minute and then move together as a flock. They're headed back to Klipsch's house, 40 miles away in Sunset Hills.
They got a little bit of a east-southeast wind, so they're gonna be a little bit faster than they normally would, which means that we gotta travel a little faster than we normally would.
He hops into his van and peels out of the parking lot, trying to beat the birds home. From the driver's seat, he says he's training them, gradually increasing the distance of the releases to build up their endurance.
They got to train to get their respiratory system working. They got to train to get their muscle system working. You know, it's like any athlete. They're athletes of the sky.
Klipsch is a third-generation pigeon racer and a member of the Mount Pleasant Homing Pigeon Club, a group that's been racing these birds in St. Louis since the 1920s. On a muggy August evening, half a dozen members gather at their clubhouse, a small brick garage in South City. Its walls are covered in paintings of past champion pigeons done by the members themselves. Tonight, they're bringing their pigeons to prep for the first race of the season. Each bird has a plastic band on its leg with a tiny chip inside. Klipsch holds the pigeons up to an electronic reader, like scanning a candy bar at the grocery store.
This registers the band number 302, and we're checking that. That's 302. He's ready to go in a race.
In less than an hour, they've registered all 49 pigeons for the race and tucked them into specially designed steel cages, outfitted with food and water troughs.
That's it. All in.
Outside, Jason Sadorf is just pulling up in his truck. He's in charge of driving the birds about 150 miles away to Lebanon, Missouri. He'll release them early the next morning by pulling a lever that opens all of the cage doors simultaneously.
You can actually stand up to about 10 feet away from the trailer and you can feel the wind and the movement from the birds flying out of the trailer. It's almost like a helicopter taking off. You can feel the downforce from all the birds flapping and wanting to fly.
The birds will all fly back to their individual homes, where they'll be scanned to make note of their exact arrival time. That way, the racers can figure out which pigeons flew the fastest. Club member Kevin Sweeney says this group is passionate about pigeons, but there's more to it than that. They're friends who like to spend time together, even if they sometimes disagree.
Like anything else, you're going to get political differences, and if you ask five different
pigeon flyers, an opinion about something, you're going to get five answers. It's just the way it is.
For many of these racers, this has been a Saturday night tradition since they were kids, when their parents got together to race. But the size of this club has dwindled in recent years, and members say they're worried that someday soon it might disappear altogether.
It's silly to let a club like this go downhill because everybody's getting older. Young people just don't know about it.
Roy Wolf lives in Eureka and just joined the club this spring. He's bred show rabbits for the past 45 years, but he says he's always wanted to have pigeons. For him, there's something alluring about the idea of turning a bird loose and having it come home to you. Wolf says most people don't understand how special these animals are.
They think they're flying rats. They don't realize that the homing pigeon is completely different than the wild pigeon. I mean, day and night difference.
His grandkids, he says, have already asked if they can start raising pigeons with him. I'm Shayla Farzon.
As natural disasters continue to batter America's coasts and devastate crops, animals are in danger of losing their natural habitats. But there is hope. Land on the banks of the Mississippi River is acting as a sanctuary for animals fleeing the effects of climate change. Mariana Bacchiao has more.
On the Illinois side of Lock and Dam 13, Ayer Sand Prairie State Nature Preserve is just one of many stops along what scientists are calling natural highways. They're stretches of diverse landscapes resilient to climate change, and the Nature Conservancy has mapped where they connect across the contiguous United States. Jeff Walk is Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy in Illinois. He says these regions are uniquely suited to weather climate change because of their biodiversity, and the Natural Highways Project looks to preserve its variety of plant life and soil types.
Rather than trying to predict what types of changes might happen to the climate, looking at it from the perspective of what are the areas that are likely to sustain a diversity of plants, animals, fish, wildlife, regardless of what happens with climate change. And so this is an analysis that looked at a couple of things, looking for neighborhoods, if you will, that provide a lot of options for different places for plants and animals to survive. So looking at areas that have an interesting mix of slope, aspect, different soil types, for example, sandy areas, clay soils, limestone outcrops are some of the examples from our area.
Some animals are already on the move, like the family of armadillos Walker's staff found in Shawnee National Forest. And some are just starting their journey across these natural highways.
One species that I think about in the context of this particular analysis is the eastern box turtle, cute little woodland turtle that's fairly common in the southern half of Illinois and across Missouri, and could move northward, but would need important corridors like the woodlands along the Mississippi River for them to get to more forested landscapes that we might encounter in Wisconsin and Minnesota, for example.
Walker says the agricultural landscape of Iowa and Illinois, the rows of flat land, uniform soil type, and a lack of diverse plant life makes it harder for animals like the eastern box turtle to navigate the natural highways. That's why the Nature Conservancy is narrowing the focus of its conservation efforts on land that connects animals to more sustainable habitats. Like Ayer Sand Prairie, just north of the Quad Cities. Randy Nyber, Director of Field Surveys, has been involved in nature conservation for over 40 years.
There was a little sparrow there. That looked like a swamp sparrow, but they're moving through right now, too. Some of those will stay around all winter. You can kind of see them sitting up there in the bush. See him sitting up there, and it's kind of, there he goes, diving. He went diving down into it.
He says the area is a respite from the surrounding agricultural landscape.
Great habitat blocks that used to cover the entire state that just aren't here anymore. You know, a lot of these species adapted to this stuff originally, and they've always found safe havens or been able to utilize the areas that have been affected like this. And I'm sure it knocks back some of the populations, but for the most part, they seem to be able to respond. And the more of these habitat islands like this that we have, the better they're going to be able to come back.
Nyber was at Morrison State Park when the derecho hit in August. He says he's never seen anything like it. It destroyed power lines and the park's forested areas, including oaks that help warblers migrate in the spring. but the sand prairie was left intact. The storm hit during the peak of monarch butterfly migration in Illinois, but Niebuhr says numbers from early September showed a good number of the monarchs had survived the windstorm.
We were really concerned we were going to lose a lot of those butterflies because of the strength of the winds and that sort of thing. But I think because the spring was somewhat delayed, that the butterflies got here a little bit later from down in Mexico, that when that derecho hit, there were a lot of the monarchs that were in the caterpillar stage and in chrysalis stage.
Regions like the Ayer Sand Prairie don't just help animals. Since they're usually located along rivers and streams, they help to stabilize the soil and filter drinking water. Maintaining water quality in those streams helps animals find their way to larger sustainable habitats and keep the water in reservoirs safe to drink for people across the Midwest. I'm Mariana Bacayao.
If you're taking up gardening during the pandemic, you're certainly not alone. COVID gardens popped up all over the country last year with more people working from home and wanting to grow their own food. And that has led to a huge spike in demand for seeds. And as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, seed companies are struggling to keep up.
Steve Larimore was hoping to triple the size of his garden this year near Bend, Oregon. Once his seed catalog arrived, he started to put his order together, and then he hit a snag.
Out of about 60 items I ordered, a third of them were sold out already.
Tomatoes, kale, lettuces, sweet corn, all gone. He couldn't even get a hold of his favorite zucchini, the Zucchino Rampicante.
That was one I was really looking forward to growing again because it did very well. And it's quite unusual. It gets about 2 to 3 feet long and curls up in all kinds of interesting shapes.
Home gardeners across the country are facing similar problems sourcing seeds for their spring gardens. Last year, nurseries and seed companies saw historic levels of demand, and so far, this year is no different.
The closest before COVID hit was during Y2K. Y2K was just a little blip compared to this.
Nikos Cavagna is a purchaser for Fedco Seeds based in Maine. She says since the pandemic, Fedco has hired more customer service reps, increased the number of daily worker shifts, and had to get creative to find enough seeds. Since the pandemic started, Cavagna says they typically reach their daily ordering limit within 10 minutes.
It feels to me like the gold rush, you know, and everybody's at the starting line and the gun goes off and...
But Cavagna emphasizes, while you may not be able to get your favorite seed variety, there's no overall shortage.
It's not so much the shortage of seed, but it's that we don't have the staffing to ramp up that quickly, especially in COVID.
Baker Creek Seeds, located in Missouri, is in the same situation. Right now, it's seen 5 to 6 times more demand. Its seed packing machines just can't keep up, and managers have had to bring in more human hands to help sort and package seeds. Kathy McFarland says her seed company is also constructing a 50,000-square-foot warehouse in order to expand their operations.
We are now figuring out that that 50,000-square-foot warehouse is not big enough. We're looking to expand again already before we even have that one up and running.
The spike in seed demand is causing a shortage of certain produce varieties, and that especially poses a problem for commercial farmers. They carefully plan their yearly crop based on specific factors, things like climate, irrigation needs, harvest timing, and yield. Hans Bishop helps run Prairie Earth Farm in central Illinois, where he's in charge of seed acquisition. He says this year they've had to make some adjustments, including buying different kinds of onions.
We don't know how these like different varieties are going to perform. If we're trying something new, we're just going to have to wait and see if it performs the same or better or worse than what the varieties that we have, you know, grown to trust over the years.
Bishop's strategy next year is to try hard to get in ahead of the home gardeners when ordering his seeds. Oregon gardener Steve Larimore says he's planning on saving his seeds from this year's garden and using them as bartering stock with his garden club next year. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
That's it for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Meanwhile, if you missed part of this show or past shows, you can find them at statewideshow.com. And our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.